Welcome, everyone, to the Peaceful Planet Show. This is your host, Marcia McMahon, and you were listening to Peaceful Planet. Music is being provided by Bob Murray, and his website is www.thestarsstillshine. And Peaceful Planet is being synthesized through his mediumship, so we encourage you to tune in to his website and his great music. Now, today I want to call your attention to our very special guest, Stan Friedman, who has recently released another great book titled Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And Stan is the foremost UFO authority in the world. So you want to be sure and stay tuned for our entire show, because it's going to be riveting. And the book that he has written is just absolutely fascinating, detailing an account of the Hills where they were taken on board a craft and recalled their memories through the use of hypnosis. So before we get into aspects of this fascinating book, I want to read to you Stan's biography here. And you can access Stan's material and his books from his website, which is located at www.stantonfriedman.com. And here is his bio. Since 1967, he has lectured on the topic flying saucers are real at more than 600 colleges and over 100 professional groups in 50 states, 9 provinces, and 16 other countries. He has published more than 80 UFO papers and appeared on hundreds of radio and TV programs. He is the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident and co-authored Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. Top Secret Magic, his explosive book about the Majestic 12 group established in 1947 to deal with crash saucers, was published in 1996 and went through 6 printings. The second edition with a new 5,000-word afterword was published in September 2005, and it is in its second printing. Stan was presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award in Leeds, England in September 2002 by UFO Magazine of the UK. A documentary, Stanton T. Friedman Is Real, was broadcast in Canada in 2002. He has provided written testimony to congressional hearings, appeared twice at the UN, and been a pioneer in many aspects of ufology, including Roswell, Majestic 12, and the Betty Hill Marjorie Fish star map work, analysis of Delphos, Kansas physical trace case, and crash saucers, flying saucer technology, and challenges to the SETI, silly effort to investigate cultism. Stanton takes a clear-cut, unambiguous stand that some UFOs are alien spacecraft, that the subject of flying saucers represents a cosmic Watergate, that none of the anti-UFO arguments made by a variety of noisy negativists stand up to careful scrutiny, and that we are dealing with the biggest story of the past millennium. Visits to planet Earth by alien spacecraft and the successful cover-up of governments of the best data. Alien wreckage and bodies recovered in New Mexico for 59 years. He has spent many weeks at a total of 20 documentary archives. Stan has successfully taken on many critics of flying saucers, Roswell, Majestic 12, including winning the debate at Oxford University. Welcome, Stan Friedman, to the Peaceful Planet. It's great to have you back again.
Good to be on again. Yeah. I like radio. I don't need to go anywhere to do it.
I know. Isn't it wonderful? You can just do it and enjoy it from the comfort of your own home, requiring no travel and no expense, no hotel. That's wonderful. Well,
and I get paid just as well. I better add. I mean, when I did,
I know. We're making so much money on this, right?
But well, anyway. I did when I did the Larry King show. It took from 4 a.m. one Friday morning until midnight the next day, and I got paid a Larry King mug.
Oh, is that? Oh, I saw you on that show, and you did a superb job standing up to those other cynics and critics and so on, the debunkers that he had on, and I don't think they held a candle to what you were saying, but they certainly tried to sway, you know, Larry's opinion and steal the show. I noticed that a few times, that they were not polite to you at all, and they weren't listening.
Well, I got my revenge. The guy who was sitting next to me, Dr. Michael Shermer, who publishes The Skeptic magazine and edits it, he and I debated on Coast to Coast Radio on August the 1st for 3 hours from here in my office, in my bathrobe at 3 in the morning. And I got 80% of the vote, so I got my revenge.
I know. The general public generally accepts the idea that there are these sightings that are very frequent, and it's pretty obvious that if you follow any of this with any degree of scrutiny, you have to wonder why the government is so intent on covering this up. And it does appear to be a massive cover-up, especially the Roswell incident, but we had you on for that. I'd like to delve right into your next book, which is titled Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO.
No, that's my last book. I got another one coming next year.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I've got to read that, too, because everything you do is so... You're such a fine researcher. Everything you do is well-researched, and you don't mess around. You make sure you can back up all your facts and all your data. So it's really a scientific approach, and you are, by nature, a scientist, are you not?
Well, yes, and that's the title of the next book, will be Flying Saucers and Science. I can hit on all the bases that way, and all the little papers I've written over the years, I can take from them and make one my magnum opus or whatever they call it.
Well, for sure. You've had a lifelong commitment to this topic, and I'm sure it hasn't been an easy road. You know, we were saying prior to coming on air, I was wondering, well, why is Stan still alive? So many people who do this kind of research put their very lives at stake, and I know the last guest I had on last week even, who is by nature, like myself, a psychic and a communicator with the higher realms, has had these ET encounters and possibly some kind of an abduction experience with her family. And she was warned a couple of times by the U.S. government never to speak of it, that her life would be in danger. So I do know that various people get threats from time to time, and I'm impressed with your record.
My longevity.
Yeah, it speaks for something.
Well, somebody, I've been asked, you know, how come you're still alive, Stan? And I tell people that, look, I can't live my life looking over my shoulder. I have a live answering service. They always know where I can be reached. I tell them my room number once I get to a hotel. And I've made enough trips from Albuquerque to Roswell, 200 miles of mostly nothing. If somebody wanted to take me out, there's the opportunity. And my answer is really that I'm careful in what I say. I don't violate security. I worked under security for 14 years. I have a full appreciation of the old notion that you can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. And I've made clear I don't want technical data out on the table where Osama bin Laden and his buddies can get at it. Because they listen to the radio, they watch television, they read newspapers, too. So what I've tried to do is set it up so that the public is more ready to accept the notion that the planet's being visited. And I think that's something the government would really like to see done, but they can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been told quietly by 1, 2, 3 different people off to the side, not for public consumption, that the government's been watching me, but they like what I'm doing. They like my style. And, look, I've given lectures after dinner talks with an Air Force colonel sitting right next to me. And so there's no question they know what I'm doing. And I think I passed muster way back in the late 60s. I gave a talk in Pittsburgh at a management club of an engineering company on the second floor of a downtown hotel. It was not a public gathering. And just before I started to speak, in walks an Air Force major in uniform with an attractive woman, and that matters in this context. And so I do my lecture, and just before the question and answer period gets rolling, these two leave. And after the program, my host says, Stan, who are your friends? I said, what do you mean? Well, you saw the Air Force guy. I said, yes. I don't know who they were. I figured you invited them. That's your business to invite whoever you please. He said, I've talked to a whole bunch of people here, and nobody knew who they were. And you may have noticed there are only two other women here. One's the boss's secretary, and one edits the company paper. And so having a woman come in was very unusual. And so I don't know who they were. Maybe they made a report back to somebody. You know, maybe they were taping it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm not going to worry about it. And, you know, having worked under security, again, it's against the law to solicit classified information from people if you don't have clearance and a need to know for it. I respect that. And I get some people angry who say, don't you think we're entitled to everything? And I say, absolutely not. Suppose we have developed a better technique for monitoring the skies, for picking up pseudo-stealthy craft. Should we put that out in the open where somebody can use it to monitor us? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
So I will go on, and I, you know, maybe it's all the vitamins I take, but I must brag that I'm 73. I have never spent overnight in a hospital. I guess I did when I was born, but I mean, that's quite a while back, and I don't remember that.
Well, you certainly have a lot of enthusiasm for your subject, and I'm sure that contributes also to your longevity, good health, and yes, you're sort of like a walking miracle as far as I can tell, as far as, you know, the freedom that you're allowed to enjoy and a lack of harassment when others less renowned than yourself are being harassed. So it's very curious to me, but I'm really glad to have you on the show, and let's get right into the book Captured, and tell me, what happened to Betty and Barney Hill on the night of September 19th, 1961, according to all of your research?
Well, remember, let's give full credit where it's due. My co-author is Kathleen Marden, who's Betty's niece.
Pardon me for not mentioning her name. You're right.
Yeah, she's the executrix of her estate. She transcribed all of the hypnosis tapes. She spent the last 10 years, Betty died in 2004, so the 10 years before that, she was very close to Betty. I mean, she heard about the story the day after it happened. Betty called Kathleen's mother, her younger sister, who'd had a sighting, and told her about the sighting. Of course, at that point, they didn't know about the abduction part of the experience. But it appears that what happened is they were driving home from Canada to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is on the coast. There's a little bit of New Hampshire between Maine and Massachusetts.
Oh, that's Portsmouth. Right. I remember driving through there one time, and it's very brief, but it's there. Yeah.
Well, they'll collect the toll on the New Hampshire Turnpike, no matter how brief. But anyway, they had been going to stay overnight. Then they heard there was a hurricane coming up the coast, so they thought they ought to be home and not on the road when that hit. So they continued on late at night, nobody around. And Betty spots a strange object in the sky with lights. It was a clear night, and she watches it for a while. She uses their binoculars, their bird watchers, and she finally tells Barney, there's a flying saucer over there. And Barney poo-poos it. Must be a Piper cub. He looks over there. It must be an airplane, Betty. There aren't any flying saucers. And she kept looking at, well, look at the lights, Barney. That can't be a Piper cub. Look how it's moving. There was some stair-step motion, you know, straight up and over and up and over, and clearly not a Piper cub. And well, maybe it's a helicopter, Betty. They can move strangely. Anyway, they're talking about it. They're heading south in the valley. This thing is following the hills to their right on the ridge. And suddenly it moves out across in front of the road. Across the road, and it stops, and they look at it, and Barney gets out of the car. This happened a couple of times. And the second time, he got very agitated because he takes the binoculars. He's looking at this thing just sitting out there, big, round, maybe 60 or 80 feet in diameter, hundreds of feet away, not very far away. No blinking red lights, no wings, no tail, no visible external engines, and not a sound. And it was pretty quiet out there in the woods. New Hampshire was mostly woods at that time, still is for that matter. There are more people there now, though. But, and he looks through the windows. There's a double row of windows on this thing. And, uh-oh, scares the heck out of him, because there inside are a bunch of beings staring back at him. And he gets the very strong feeling in his head they're going to be captured. And dashes, he breaks the eye contact he had with the somebody who was on the other side of the windows, and dashes back to the car, and they go through this routine again, and finally he does some things that are strange. He makes a turn off the major highway he was on onto a secondary road, And then another turn onto a tertiary road, a dirt road, and stops the car, and that's where they get abducted. But we didn't know that until later.
Yeah.
He would never have done that if somebody hadn't been influencing his head. I was at that very location with Kathleen. And when you sit there, trees all around, here's this big empty clearing. There's a house there now, but it wasn't there then. Only place around big enough for a craft to set down in. And
I've seen the aerial
not
photograph in the book, Stan, so I know what you're talking about.
Well, it's an unusual place, and no, they would never have made those turns, except somebody upstairs was controlling them. And that's a scary notion, and it's one of the reasons that governments would be interested in abductions, because wouldn't it be nice if we could control somebody else's army and, you know, convince them to lay down their arms or stop fighting or, you know, go back to base or whatever, mentally, that is, without a gun to the head or a knife to the ribs or whatever.
Yeah, and I'm sure they are working on such, you know, things.
Well, yeah, ever since the Korean War, mind-washing, whatever you call it, brainwashing, you know, mental control of people, how do you do it? And then all those somewhat illegal experiments, feeding LSD and other things to people, you know, without permission. Anyway, we're trying to control behavior has always been a government goal. Anyway, they go through this first part of the experience. They don't remember anything about being taken on board. And they do remember getting back on the road and some strange beeping sounds and another set of beeping sounds. I do remember seeing a sign that says Concord, New Hampshire, like 17 miles. And they had talked about the fact that it was at least 39 miles. So there's a gap here of time. They drive on home, and they do notice that their watches had stopped, that they got home much later than they had expected to get home.
Yeah, and there were forensic things that came out later.
Well, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, Barney's shoes were scuffed. Now, Barney was a fastidious dresser. He would never go any place with his shoes scuffed. Betty's dress was torn, and she never wore it again after she took it off that morning. They went to bed to get some rest, and then they reported the case that day. It's important to realize they didn't sit on this and make up stories. They called Pease Air Force Base. And I should stress, Betty and Barney knew a lot of people out at the base, socially. They were active in the community. Betty was a social worker. Barney was on the Governor's Civil Rights Commission. I should mention, since this is radio, Barney was black, Betty was white, both in their 40s. This is in New Hampshire, 1961, an unusual couple to begin with,
yes,
if you will,
right,
for that time. As a matter of fact, I should point out that the television movie, which wasn't until 1975, starring James Earl Jones as Barney, incidentally, was the first time on television that a black man and white woman were in bed together. I'm just talking, but still, that was the first time, 1975. So times have changed considerably.
Yeah, and to have a mixed couple at that time was unusual, and then to add to their story, of course.
Yeah,
the story is what's so interesting about that couple.
Yeah, and it took, Betty had, they got home, they did their thing, they reported it to the base was very interested, somebody called them back, and they went at it, and we later found out there'd been a radar sighting that night and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of little
corrupt
beat. What?
Go ahead, Stan.
Well, just that there's a lot of little detail, but what really mattered was Betty had gone to the library to get a book about flying saucers, got one by Major Donald Kehoe, well-known. He's written several books. He's dead now, of course. But he had been pretty much running the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, for many years. And it was the largest organization, got as high as 14,000 members back then in the 60s.
That's pretty amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, wasn't the Air Force involved in investigating this, too, with the Project Blue Book?
Well, a report did go to Blue Book, and those files got changed, and that's described in the book, how they scratched out this and scratched out that, and their explanation, you know, it was something conventional. But what was interesting is that Betty wrote, there was an address in the back of the book by Major Kehoe, if you had a sighting, please write us, and gave an address. She wrote a letter, didn't mention the beings Barney had seen through the window. And they passed the letter on to Walter Webb, who was the NICAP investigator in New England.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent 6 hours with them getting their story. And NICAP got a few other scientists involved. And some of this wasn't known until this book came out. And it became clear that there was a missing time component. But also, Betty had some dreams within 2 weeks of the event, a series of dreams. She wrote notes on them. And one of the key things about this book is that it puts the explanation that the psychiatrist who eventually wound up hypnotizing them both separately, weekly sessions for several months, not just one session, as some people have claimed, was Dr. Benjamin Simon. Now, here was a guy who developed his techniques for recovering lost memories, I'll call them, by treating thousands, literally, of shell-shock war veterans from World War II. Post-traumatic stress syndrome, we would call it now, but then it was shell-shock veterans. He actually ran a hospital with 3,000 beds after the war. I've seen the movie that he made, Let There Be Light, that the Army made, starring him, and how he helped war veterans who'd had horrendous experiences. You know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you. Maybe that's something that's a little hard to integrate. And some people can handle this sort of thing and others can't. Anyway, Dr. Simon used the best techniques then available, probably still available, to elicit reliving of the experience that caused the trauma. And it was kind of amazing. He taped all his sessions. And he didn't know anything about flying saucers, which is maybe a good thing. Nobody can say he was biased in favor of an alien explanation.
That's absolutely true on that point. But he didn't really relieve Barney's continuing anxiety about what had happened, because it was apparently terrorizing to both of these people.
Well,
there
were two sessions in which he had to stop because the emotional level was so high. And there's a copy of a letter he wrote to somebody in which he stated that the emotional intensity on occasion with each of them was greater than that he'd seen in any of the sessions with the war veterans. Now, coming from a man like him who treated literally thousands over a many-year period, I mean, the war ended in 45. This was 64 when he finally got involved in the event. That's a very strong statement. And
the other thing that I thought was impressive was that he told the Hills that you absolutely cannot lie or tell an untruth when you're under hypnosis.
Well, not when you're under direct instructions to, mm-hmm. you know, tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. And you tell what you believe to be true. Now, you may be wrong in your beliefs, you know, your recollections. Maybe you thought you saw a thief and it was really your cousin, you know. But he tried to fit an explanation to the case, because he had an Air Force friend who said, there are no flying saucers. So he tried to make it Barney echoing Betty's dreams and feeding them back. And what's unique about this book, there are many things, but Kathy went through all the transcripts and compared what Barney said with Betty's notes about what she saw, what she dreamt, and what she remembered. And it is clear that he was not echoing what Betty had dreamt. And so it's kind of funny. In the world of the debunkers, they often try to make the point, all those hypnotists just force people into regurgitating what the hypnotist would like to have had happen. Well, here's just the other side of the coin. The hypnotist was trying to put them into a mold that didn't fit of what he hoped might have happened to explain the strange story from two obviously sensible, intelligent people. And I repeat, Betty was a social worker, supervisor, welfare department, state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office, but he was very active in civil rights. He was
both well-educated and good members of the community, as you're saying.
Yeah, I mean,
one of them would be have any reason to make this up. In fact, they were pretty adamant that this not
That's right.
All this information was to be kept strictly confidential.
Yeah, when they heard that somebody from the Boston paper was doing a series, he called them, wanted to interview them for the series he was doing, and they said absolutely not. And they, actually consulted a couple of attorneys. Was there any way to stop him? He had been given a tape from a small session they had given to friends after the hypnosis work had been done, and both of them thought they're going to lose their jobs. You know, who needs publicity? Well, the series of articles appeared, and lo and behold, much to their astonishment, the response was great from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Fuller came along. He was a well-known author. He was working on Incident at Exeter, a small town in New Hampshire, a very good UFO sighting there involving police people and others. And John heard about this from somebody, and they got together, and an agreement was worked out between Betty and Barney and Dr. Simon and John Fuller, whose book, The Interrupted Journey, when it finally came out in 66, was a major success all over the world. But there was a kicker in the agreement. Dr. Simon had final say on everything. And oh. I've seen the notes that John Fuller kept.
Mm-hmm.
His papers are at the Boston University Library in the archives. And John's did, and Dr. Simon's did. So I got access to his papers there, and Dr. Simon ran close herd on him. You can't say this, you can't say that, that would make us look foolish, etc. So probably made for a better book, a more accurate book, but still, I don't know how John put up with it. And the book was published in a number of countries, and there were two articles on Look magazine, excerpts from the book. And, you know, I didn't fully realize this, but when Kathleen and I were signing books at the MUFON annual symposium in August in Denver,
mm-hmm.
we were both there, we each gave a paper, and a lot of people told each of us that it was that story that made them aware of UFOs, that got them interested, that got them hooked. And I hadn't fully appreciated, and almost all of them recall the movie, the UFO incident it was called. The book was The Interrupted Journey, but NBC broadcast it, Universal Studios did it. I was a consultant on the movie. Would you believe I was referred to Universal by the United States Air Force? I was living in Southern California, but...
Well, I'll be darned.
I always thought of that.
They know all about you.
Well, I thought of that as being rather ironic. They were under instructions at that time, the mid-70s. Refer anybody who talks about UFOs to some local scientist, and I guess they were aware of me. I did a lot of media stuff in Southern California, so...
So what was the name of the film that was done about the Hill?
The UFO Incident, and it isn't out on DVD, which I tried to... I was in contact with James Earl Jones' people. He had the movie rights for the film at that time, but he doesn't anymore, and I sure think it should be put out again. I mean, you know, throw in some outtakes and all the rest of it, but... I got to be talking to Universal Studios and tell them about the book and say, you know, this would help sales of your movie, and your movie would help sales of the book.
Absolutely. They could even do a little piece, you know, of
sure.
you talking at the end or something. You know, that would be great publicity. And it does sound like it's a worthy film. I don't remember.
It was. I was very pleased with it. I'm not greatly enamored of many television so-called documentaries. This was more a real film, but... The director of the movie told me when I was over there at Universal that after reading the book, and he decided that this story was probably true, and therefore that had two impacts on him. One, he recognized the aliens could watch it, and he didn't want to make a horror story. And second, he thought he ought to tell the story accurately. And I think he did. There were very few complaints about it. There were some minor errors. But as UFO movies go, this one was head and shoulders among most. And I got lots of comments from people. Betty and I did a promotional appearance on the Tom Snyder Tomorrow Show.
Oh, I remember the Tom Snyder Show. Sure, yeah.
We did it just before, maybe 3 days before the movie was shown. And... because of that, a lot of people linked me with it. You know, this is before the internet, but still, we were very pleased at the response, and it shows you that you can do these things right. Now, I don't know how much money it costs them. Not much for me, I'll tell you that. But
yeah, well, I would think it'd be, you know, it being a worthy goal to maybe put together another one or revive the other one's standing.
We have some interest, but I can't say from whom, but there is some interest on making a film out of our book. One of the things...
Well, I would think that would be more riveting, because your book is absolutely riveting. I mean, I want to get into the actual abduction experience that you document through the retrieval of these hypnosis tapes and everything, and what these aliens look like and what they experienced, if you wouldn't mind going
well,
in
sure.
that direction.
One of the things that shows up when Kathy transcribed all the tapes. Now, in John Fuller's book, he would take one pass at any question, but Dr. Simon asks some of the same questions several different times from different directions, so to speak. So we have a lot more insight, literally information. And one of the things that comes across, besides the drawings of the beings, and there were several kinds, but all humanoid, that is, two arms.
And they're all very interesting. I'm looking at the one here by artist Patrick Richard, and boy, you know, I mean, these are as they were described, and
yeah.
I can't imagine the horror of going through something like an abduction. I have no personal experience with any of this, but I've talked to others who have, and it must have been just terrifying.
Well, remember, they had
hands all over them.
They had nothing to compare it to. There had been no publicity about any abductions anywhere, really. There was a case down in Brazil, but most people here certainly didn't know about it, the AVB case. He was taken on board in Brazil, and a woman was brought in, and they had sex after he was washed with some strange kind of fluid and stuff. But Americans didn't know about that case.
Nobody. It was all covered up back then, and it's still being covered up largely.
Well, there's a cosmic Watergate. There's no question about that. My book, Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C, goes into that in some length, and that'll
there
be
absolutely is, and it's just a really sad thing that this is being covered up to the extent that it is, because the public really deserves to know this is the biggest story that's ever hit mankind, I think.
Well, yeah, I use the term in the last millennium, because if I go two millennia, then I get arguments from some religious people, and some of them, it's a viewpoint of, say, Pat Robertson, that there is no other intelligent life outside of Earth. This UFO stuff is the work of the devil. And so they're dead set against. The late Jerry Falwell have said the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's an insult to the notion of God to think that this is the best she can do.
I absolutely agree. I mean, these people have got a long way to go to grow up with their fundamentalist adherence to rigid ideas.
Yeah.
Again,
and
all that
so,
rigidity really turns me off. But I hear the same thing in my work, in the psychic work, and the channeling that I do, which is, basically regarded as the
spirit world, call it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, the spirit world and the world of the aliens, I mean, there are people who channel aliens. You know, I channel people from spirit, but I work with a soul group known as Ra, and it's better known in the work of Carla Ruckert, who has a station here on BDS. And this Ra material that she has is extremely accurate, and they talk about this thing called the Galactic Federation, which is an advanced group, some ascended, of beings that are of a higher dimensional intelligence and so on, that sort of oversee things here on Earth. And people are completely, you know, a lot of people are still blind to the truth of truth.
They're oblivious.
Yes. And the thing is, you know, with all the brainwashing that religion does and all the brainwashing that the media does and all the brainwashing that the government, you know, inadvertently does on behalf of the media, you have this situation where people are ignorant of it, you know? So, I mean, you've got to do your thing and bring your truth out. And I do my best to bring mine out. And I know you're doing your best to bring yours out. And I think it's
only 700 lectures so far.
Yeah, I know. And I want to get to the abduction experience, because it's so absolutely riveting. And so if you could go into some details about
yeah, they parked their car. Two groups of aliens come at them, one on one side, one on the other. They open the doors. Betty tried to run away, one on each side, or two people on each side of each of them. And I'm tempted to say carry, but tug along, completely under their control. And Barney's shoes being scuffed, I mentioned that, because they were basically dragging him across the ground. A couple on each side. Barney did have a gun, incidentally, and it wasn't because he was afraid of aliens, but when they stopped the car to let the dog out to do his thing, in an area where there are garbage cans and maybe bears and stuff like that, Barney thought he ought to be prepared.
Yeah. May I interrupt for one,
sure.
one second here, Stan? I completely forgot to, and I apologize to you and our audience, but I meant to open our phone line. So just for a brief moment, I'd like to interject that
sure.
if you have a question for Stan Friedman and you'd like to ask him about anything, you're welcome to give us a call here at BBS at 877-876-5227 or toll-free in Canada, 888-810-8322. And so, you know, our show's going to continue on for about another 10 minutes or so. So go on with the alien abduction experience and some of the evidence that came to light and, you know, just
well,
maybe what they saw.
They got taken on board. They went up a ramp. They're, I won't say semi-conscious, but something like that, obviously under control,
mm-hmm.
and put in different rooms. They did physical. The aliens did physical examinations on them with Betty. Stick a needle here, scrape some skin there, take a little hair here. You know, specimen. And when they got it all finished, there was one funny little thing. The aliens come in. They're in separate rooms, and the aliens come and start pulling at Betty's teeth. And she asked the leader, hey, what's going on here? Well, they couldn't understand why Barney's teeth came out and hers didn't, which was kind of funny.
Well, didn't they have a hard time with Betty's zipper and there was permanent...
Well, yeah, they had a problem with Betty's zipper, and maybe they don't use zippers up there. Maybe they're a Velcro world. You know, who knows?
Probably I mean, in, you know, the little silver suits that are sort of
yeah,
made for them, you know?
They get treated okay, except they put a big needle in Betty's navel, and she saw it coming at her, and she screamed, it's going to hurt, and they said no, and it did hurt, and they were surprised that it did, and the leader waved his hand in some kind of peculiar way, and the pain slowly went away, which made Betty sort of grateful and relaxed. I mean, obviously, they didn't have evil designs on them if they stopped the pain. And out of that came her attempts, when they were finished with her, to find out, she asked the leader, in the understatement of the year, she says, I know you're not from around here. Where are you from? And, you know, Betty knows who she is. I mean, her family came over in like 1634 or something in New England, and very different from Barney, whose grandfather was a slave. I mean, Betty, you know, her mother lived in the same house for 90 years in New England. Anyway, the leader shows her what I can only describe as a three-dimensional model. I'll call it a hologram, really, because that's what it was, except the word wasn't in use at that time. We think that's what it was. And she's looking at it, up at this thing, 3 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet deep, and a bunch of lines connected with points of light, which are supposedly stars. Heavy trade routes, light trade routes, and occasional expeditions. And Betty's looking at this thing, and she says, well, where are you on the map? And the wise guy alien says, do you know where you are? No, I don't know anything about astronomy. Well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at? End of discussion. Now, you can imagine Dr. Simon listening to this, trying to figure out. I mean, he's got two sensible people telling him this crazy story. Trade routes? Expeditions? So he makes sure that Betty can remember the map accurately, gives her a post-hypnotic suggestion, if and only if she can remember it accurately. Please draw it later on. She does. And it's in the book, your first book, The Interrupted Journey, and in Captured as well. And the problem is, what sense do you make out of it? 16 points connected by three kinds of lines, supposedly stars connected with trade routes and so forth. At the time the first book was published, there was no way to make sense out of that. Because of the book, a woman named Marjorie Fish read the story. She was a brilliant woman, member of Mensa. She was a school teacher in Ohio at the time. She visited Betty. She was dubious at first because she didn't think aliens could look anything like us. That's part of the brainwashing from the noisy negativists. It's unlikely they would look anything like us, as if we had a catalog, you know, and we could say 10% have four arms or whatever. We don't have any such catalog. Anyway, her project was to see if she could find a three-dimensional pattern that matched the two-dimensional one Betty had drawn. She built a total of 26 different three-dimensional models, little beads on fish line, and looking at it from all different directions. And it took an awful lot of work and new models, new data on the distances to the stars, which is the hard part. We've got good angular data, even back then, to look at a particular star. But we have had lousy distance data. Now we have a great deal of new data from the Hipparco satellite, but we didn't then. Anyway, to make a long story short, Marjorie built all these models and rebuilt some when a new catalog came out of the distance data, found one and only one pattern that matched angle for angle, line length for line length, what Betty had drawn, and enables us to identify all the stars, 16 stars. And they're all the right kind for planets and life. And the base stars turn out to be Zeta 1 and Zeta...
I believe we have a phone call. Do we have a caller on the line?
Yes, hi, Marja. It's Carrie.
Carrie. I'm so glad you called in. Sorry to interrupt you, Stan.
That's all right.
Come back to the story. Yes, what was your question or comment?
Well, my question was, what is your personal conclusion of the purpose in which we are being visited by these beings?
Okay, that's a legitimate question. Let me refer you to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and there's a paper on there, the UFO why questions, W-H-Y. One of them is, what's the reasons for the cover-up? Another is, what are the reasons for coming here? Why would anybody care about this darn place anyway? And I give a whole bunch of reasons there. You know, they're broadcasters of the weekly show, Idiocy in the Boondocks. This is the honeymoon capital of this corner of the galaxy. The aliens are being punished. If you're a bad boy, you'll spend 2 weeks on Earth. That's punishment to last a lifetime. It turns out this is the densest planet in the solar system. I don't mean the people. I mean the planet. That means there are more heavy metals here. That includes gold, uranium, osmium, rhenium, platinum, which all have special characteristics. Look at all the people who went west for gold, to California, to Alaska, to Australia. And there's a whole bunch of reasons like this. But bottom line, I think the primary reason is to quarantine us. Because from their viewpoint, go back a step. I make one assumption about every advanced civilization. It's concerned about its own survival and security. Everybody we know, that's true for. We're spending $500 billion this year on survival and security, I guess. Anyway, that being the case, you have to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs on those primitives who show signs of being able to bother you. At the end of World War II, all of a sudden, there were three signs that any visiting alien from, let's say, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, the base stars from the star map I was just talking about, only 39 light years away, and I'll tell you what's special about them in a minute. But there were three signs that would lead any visitor to the conclusion that soon, meaning less than 100 years, we Earthlings, if we didn't destroy ourselves first, would be out there taking our brand of friendship, which everybody else considers hostility. The three signs were nuclear weapons, V-2 rockets,
yeah,
which weren't used to deliver mail from Germany to England, and powerful radar is an indication of new developments in electronics. You put them all together, and in less than 100 years, we'll be going out there. Now, I should point out that the only place in the world in July 1947 where you could check on all three of these technologies was southeastern New Mexico. At White Sands Missile Range is where the first atom bomb was tested, Trinity Site, 1945. That's where, from 46 through 47, we were testing the captured German V-2 rockets. And that's where we had our best radar to track the rockets, which sometimes didn't go where they were supposed to go. Now, I went through this routine for an English astronomer who said, well, they could have gone to the Soviet Union. Sorry, they didn't test their first nuclear weapon until August 1949, 2 years later. What I'm saying is maybe it makes sense that they were in southeastern New Mexico.
Absolutely.
Presuming they'd want to know what these idiots were up to. So
yes, there was the atom bomb that they were working on. There were all these changes. And apparently, you know, these vibrations do carry throughout universes when bombs like this go off.
They've been checking us out sooner than that. As soon as
oh,
we
I
went
think so too.
industrial. In other words, steel mills put garbage in the sky, and other things do, and radio waves, go back 100 years or so. But it's important to realize Friedman's Law. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. The laser pointers I use, they're not just better flashlights. Now, that's important because the base stars from this star map work that I was talking about are Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. That's the constellation Reticulum, the net, that means in Latin. These two stars are the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire local neighborhood. The sun is isolated. Next star over, 4.3 light years. Next star over, that's similar to the sun, not too hot, not too cold, not too old, not too new, etc., is about 11 light years away. Well, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, that's the Greek letter Zeta, are only 39 light years from here, 39.3, but they're only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. That means they're 35 times closer to each other than our star, the sun, is to the next star over. We're out in the boonies. These guys got next-door neighbors. And, oh, yes, they're a cool billion years older than the sun. And from a planet around one looking over at the other, you can directly observe it all day long. So you'd expect them to have gotten into interstellar travel long before we did. And even if it's only 1,000 years instead of a billion, they're going to be way ahead of us technologically. I worked on fusion propulsion systems back in the early 60s. Nuclear fusion is what powers all the stars, so every advanced civilization is going to know about that. And yeah, even for us, if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back, they'd only have 10 million times as much energy per particle as you can get in a dumb old chemical rocket.
Yep.
Progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. So they long since bypassed the slide rule. I mentioned slide rules to a college audience. Nobody in the two classes that were together knew what I was talking about, even though I used one when I started work in industry less than 50 years ago.
Carrie, this is Stan Friedman, and Carrie is the lady that was on my show last week who has had these experiences with abduction in her family. So I think it's great that you decided to call in, Carrie. And Stan, thank you for that answer. It was phenomenal.
Well, I've been at this a long time, and people may wonder, what the heck is a nuclear physicist who's best known for being the first civilian investigator of the Roswell incident doing with an abduction case? Well, I had dinner with Betty and Barney way back in 1968, and Barney died 3 months later, not because of the dinner, and I've seen Betty many times. I was the first to publish about the star map work we're talking about.
Yeah, the star map sounds really awesome. And, way ahead of its time because there were no computers to chart these stars. So, Carrie, thank you so much for calling in. Did you have anything else to add to that?
Well, I wanted to ask one more quick question, if I may.
Sure.
Okay, we're running out of time but we have about a minute left, so go ahead.
Well, it's my understanding from watching these interviews with Bob Dean and Bill Holden and other people who are now also talking, that these particular beings from Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2 are from our future, 45,000 years in the future and 52,000 years in the future. What is your understanding of that?
I have no reason to say that that's true or false. It's in my gray basket at best. There's nothing in the Hill case, and it's interesting. Nobody mentioned Zeta 1 or Zeta 2 Reticuli until I published the first star map article in the early 70s. So I don't know where that came from. Other people jumped on the bandwagon. If it's true and they knew about it, how come they didn't mention it before that is what I'm saying. So I can't say it's impossible. I don't know. All I know is that I have no basis for saying it's true.
Perhaps our comprehension of zero time or the timeline in the Mayan calendar were not able to conceive it at that time?
Who knows? I don't know.
Well,
I don't have answers to all the questions.
These guys travel may be through some sort of wormhole thing. I mean, they may.
Sure. Why not?
They may be able to go beyond time, and it's not impossible. Boy, we could really go on, and we are almost at the end of our show. Sherry, I'm going to put you in touch with Stan through email and let you guys chat about some of your experiences. And thank you for calling in. We so appreciate all of the questions, and we so appreciate you coming on the show, Stan, and all of your fine research. And I want to mention the book again. It's Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, and you can pick that book up. You can order it online, I think, right? On
Yeah, PayPal at www.stantonfriedman.com. There are other books, too. I've got a couple other books.
That's spelled Friedman.
Very important.
Yes, and you do want to look up his website and see all of his wonderful information that's up there, and there's all these other books that you can tap into. So, you know, Stan, it was a real pleasure having you on again, and you really handle everything so well, and you're fascinating, and you're a wonderful guest. And we'll certainly have you back when you publish the next one. So we'll
stay
in touch. Thank you, Carrie, for calling in, and thank you to all of our listening audience. We're going to close out with a song in honor of Stan's work called The Stars Still Shine by Bob Murray. Thanks again for joining us, Stan and Carrie,
thank
and
you.
I'll put you two in touch. Thanks again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.